The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
It seems since time immemorial, same fashion, dictatorial, have set the styles the debutant shall wear.
Will you look at those lovely creatures? Look at that one. As tasty and tempting and toothsome and trim and tiny a tidbit. Now, let's see, where was I? It's too bad that she's not the real McCoy.
Oh, but I am real.
Who are you, anyway?
Well, I'm a professional model, of course.
This is, for me, a very special opportunity to see this dress on. It doesn't go on very often. It's, the most exquisite silks, organdy, and what you see here is a very stylish woman who would have been considered a flapper wearing this, because one of the...
Why the model is important is that she is transmitting the changes in women's lives and not just the changes in fashion. It's the power of persona that's being developed. Do you represent the look and the value of the time?
And here we have more of a day look for the 1920s. Again, with all this wonderful adventure and travel.
In 1923, the first modeling agency is formed in New York City. Models like Marion Morehouse and Lee Miller become known by name, and they are completely different from the previous generation. This is a modern, liberated woman. Women are driving, they're drinking, they're voting. It's a cultural revolution.
The 20s. Flaming youth and the flappers. It was the era of cloche hats, bobbed hair, and bootleggers.
With her eyes upon the clock, she will change to lunch and frock as she plans a stroll upon the avenue.
I don't know why I love you like I do. I don't know why, I just do.
The history of fashion is an important part of social history, especially for women. What they, we, have been allowed to wear always reflected the roles that they, we, were required to play in society. The choices were limited. But by the 20th century, women began to make their own choices in everything, including what they wore and how they wore it. And fashion began to reflect the choices they were making. They couldn't do what they wanted to do, which was to take part in the life of the world outside the home, if they were trussed in corsets or dragging skirts sewn from whole rolls of cloth. Everything had to simplify and speed up so they could get out. The poster women for modernity in the early 20th century were a new kind of professional wearers of clothes, mannequins who modelled garments in couture salons. They became famous for how they looked, posed, walked and displayed the modes in a new theatrical way on stages and in parades on raised walkways, what we call the catwalk. Besides the clothes, they always wore, as one of our authors today calls it, the mechanical smile. She's Caroline Evans, Professor of Fashion History at London's Central St Martins, who's written a history of the catwalk and its mannequins from 1900 to 1929. With me in the studio as well is the writer and cultural commentator, Veronica Horwell. Caroline, tell us where the phrase the mechanical smile came from.
Well, it came from me, but derived on a great many of the written sources I read from commentators on the first fashion models, first fashion shows, and they all unfailingly were rather disturbed by the mechanical nature of the fashion model's performance.
You make the point at various points about the ambiguity of the position of the fashion model. So you say her physical malleability mirrors the psychological malleability of the new woman, and her embodiment, highly disturbing to contemporaries, of future sensibilities. There's a big reality packed into these bodies.
Yes, there is a big reality, and I think that that's why she's very different, in fact, from the figure of the actress, who has a sort of cozy sexuality that is familiar to her audiences. And the first audiences for fashion models always found them rather chilling. And in fact, the fashion model performance today is still, I think, an uncanny performance. And that modelling style is a very different form of self-presentation situation. A woman who, if you like, voluntarily turns herself into a kind of object or a kind of machine, a very beautiful, smiling, ambiguous machine, perhaps. It's quite different from the sort of cinematic or theatrical images of women we're used to, in which women are in some way alluring, trying to be sexy for their audience. And this very cool performance, I think, is the antithesis of sexiness in that sense, or of a kind of come hither style of performance.
Why do you pick such a very specific time frame?
Partly because of when they started. I did actually start out doing the whole of the 20th century and every country everywhere, and then I realised that was ridiculous and couldn't be done. And although I'd always written more about contemporary fashion, I found myself becoming much more interested in the earlier period. So I chose instead to look at the beginnings of the fashion show, so that explains the 1900, which is approximately when they start, although there are 19th century antecedents for fashion modelling. And because I was working on France in America, I stopped in 1929 because that was the year of the Great Crash, and that had a big impact on the international trade relations in fashion between America and the rest of the world.
Veronica, this is an exquisite book, isn't it? Huge, great coffee table book, beautiful pictures.
I had it on the floor as being the best place to read it, which often happens with Yale books. It's there to show as much as say. And it's very important that it shows as much as says, because many of the things that it's about are to do with self-presentation of the body on which the textiles are almost exiguous. Modernity, in this definition, is a complete representation of how women should be or could be. And that actually starts with the movement, whether it's walking, posturing, or gesturing. There are marvellous sections on gestures. The history of the gesture is as important to the history of fashion as the history of the corset, in fact, more so. And that's, in fact, what modernity went into, the world of moving, presenting yourself as how you thought your body should be, without a great deal of help from the garments concerned.
There are two kinds of posing, really. There's the frozen pose, and then there's the way that melts and flows into motion. And that itself is very cinematic, in fact. And the first fashion shows coincide exactly with the period of the first film. I completely agree with Veronica. I think, you know, gesture and pose and this idea of movement are far more central to these ideas about the presentation of the self than fashion. And the book turned out to be about almost everything except fashion design, in a sense. I mean, it's a history of commerce and culture and women and work and the body and the pose and the gesture, much more than, although there are a little bit about, you know, skirt lengths and design and that sort of thing. And perhaps because this period coincides with the period of the first film, which is a hugely important, I think by far and away the most important new cultural form in the early 20th century, there's a very wide fascination with this question of motion and stasis, how you show motion in still images, which is such a contradictory endeavour, but which people try so hard to do, and even philosophers like Bergson are thinking about these questions at the time.
Yes, it's the idea that you can arrest time in a new way. By then you've had almost 80 years of stopping time dead in the photograph, and suddenly you're into the world where you can incrementally hitch, glitch time, stop, 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 stop. And this, paradoxically, makes it seem as if everything is moving much faster, including, for example, the changes in fashion, that is garment-type fashion. These accelerate at the same time, partly because of communicability, because the whole point of fashion presentation in a salon at this time becomes something that you can communicate through new media much faster and much more widely. There's an amazing amount of democratization in this book. The Americans, in particular, took hold of couture and democratized it like crazy in the movies, on Broadway, in traveling fashion shows, which are so modern that they take your breath away, except that they're a century back.
Yes, no, I think it's really interesting. And although, you know, one always hesitates to draw really sort of facile comparisons between past and present, but nevertheless, there are some really important moments about changes in new media, new communications, new forms of presenting the self, I think, between then and now. So that although it was a very different moment, there are similarities today with the way that new communications have changed fashion communication via the web. But I also wanted to go back to one thing you said about gesture, because that's so interesting, because although that was so much about being of the moment, it also has a much older and longer history. You know, going back to the days when people taught deportment, taught to dancing, taught fencing, even taught how to bow and curtsy and how to behave socially, so that the idea of the body itself as natural is a much more recent and 20th century one. You know, no one really teaches us. We dress ourselves up. Some people may have surgery or do exercise in the gym, but still we have some idea that bodily motion itself, dancing, these are sort of natural things that we're either good at or bad at, rather than learning. And I think the fashion show is on the cusp of a lot of things that were both old and new, because it went back to that 18th century tradition of striking attitudes, being taught how to move, the idea that bodily movement itself can be fashionable or unfashionable. But it's also, I think, there are links to be made forward at the same time into new ways of picturing the self through new technology and new communications. So obviously things like Instagramming and the net would be the most obvious parallels to make today.
Oh my God.
That's enough of women displaying themselves. There's another very diverse and growing population who want to use their clothing to conceal rather than reveal, who dress to command respect, not admiration. They're the subject of our second author, Rena Lewis, from the London College of Fashion. She's edited a collection of essays under the title Modest Fashion, Styling Bodies, Mediating Faith. Rena, I have the book in front of me, and the cover image is a striking picture of a very glamorous young woman on a huge silver motorbike wearing a polka dot hijab.
It's gorgeous, isn't it? And I was very lucky to be given permission to use an extract from this artwork by the Moroccan-British artist Hassan Hajjaj, who is also a designer and a retailer, so he covers all the areas of my work. But he does a lot of fantastic photo shoots in Morocco, using friends often as models, who are often themselves musicians and artists and cultural producers. And he makes these clothes. And this is, of course, a made-up modest outfit. I don't think you'll ever find anyone wearing anything like this. So she's wearing a sort of gauzy section over her face as if it's a niqab or a face veil, and then some sort of abaya or djellaba combination over her body on this bike. And I chose it because of its playfulness and sense of motion, and because the motorbike, of course, is so emblematic of modernity, and thinking of Caroline's work of speed and of men. And she's got, you know, finely plucked eyebrows, eyeshadow, and she's looking out at you confidently and assertively.
Not modestly, it has to be said.
Not modestly, but that, of course, also raises the question of what modesty is. And on one hand, modesty is about respect, but it's not about admiration as well. And whilst many women would say questions of self-respect and trying to ensure the respect of others is part of their motivation, it isn't the case that everybody doesn't wish for themselves to be admired for their clothing, the way they present, their choice of clothing. And that's often one of the central conundrums, because definitions of modesty vary from person to person, from religion to religion, and indeed any given woman may change her definition of modesty during the course of her lifetime in relation both to personal events, so having children, taking a new job, leaving home, and macro political events, so the bans on the niqab in France or the previous cases or recent cases in Israel with the ultra-Orthodox trying to control public spaces.
Is there a whole community of people thinking about modest fashion? This interests me because it's not something I've ever encountered before.
There are more people looking at this subject now, partly because I think it has become so much more prevalent in what we might call the West, particularly with young Muslim women who are wearing the headscarf or hijab, or also because of recent political controversies over visibly Muslim dress. So one of the things that I did with this book was try to pull people from different areas of ethnography, anthropology, art history, sociology, fashion studies, dress studies, material culture, and so on. And for some of them, modesty wasn't the primary focus of their work, but they were very willing to engage with thinking about how it factors into the work that they're doing. The other thing is that I want to do with this book is shift the focus away from the obsessive attention to what Muslim women are wearing and think about other women and what they're wearing as well.
Is it specifically female?
There are religions that have codes of dress and body management as well, because again, as with Caroline's work, it's not just the clothes that you put on, it's how you manage the body, how you look, what you do with your voice, the spaces that you're seen in and who sees you. So there are many practices for men that do involve modest behavior and dressing. But I have focused on women because it is generally women that bear the burden of representation in the focus both within their communities and outside their communities. And certainly for diaspora communities of any sort, it is far more frequently women who are seen as the carriers and the transmitters of traditional community values, whether those are ethnic values or religious values.
There's a fascinating chapter by Daniel Miller on denim. I particularly mention this because you want to move away from it just being about Muslim dressing. Veronica, you're a bit into denim, aren't you?
Because it's a textile which has an enormously elaborate hierarchy of meanings. And in the case of Miller's essay, it's about a meaning of plainness, ordinariness, the basic textile of our times, as a heavy, fairly heavy black wool was the basic textile of the 19th century. It's the default setting of life.
So he basically is picking up on the fact that certain Orthodox Jewish communities in Israel and in New York have banned denim, the wearing of denim.
Denim is avoided by some members of the ultra-Orthodox, although other ultra-Orthodox Jews wear it almost as a uniform. So every girl's wearing maxi skirts in various shades of denim with and without flounces. What's interesting in the New York example, and also Barbara Carol Goldman talks about this in her piece, is that for some ultra-Orthodox Jewish groups, they wish to make a distinction between themselves and secular dressers who are seen as not dressing smartly enough. So they want to make a distinction based on standing out, not just because of the way they're covered, but because of the way that they are taking care of themselves and presenting as smart.
It's not just about Judaism and Islam, although both feature, but Christianity as well. You talk a lot about. Give us some examples of modest dressing there.
The Christian group that was most involved in this were the Mormons, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which of course then became very contemporaneous when Mitt Romney was running for president. Their modesty codes are also very different in that what they need to cover is not so much parts of the body, but the sacred garment that many Mormons wear underneath their clothing. But whilst earlier generations of Mormons would want to cover further down the arms and wear longer trousers and skirts, younger women might be happy, for example, with something midway down the forearm and a shorter skirt and with something that's more figure-hugging. So the requirements can be very different.
Another one is the bikini, isn't it? Which I think was fascinating, that it, suddenly the bikini, a modest way Islamic way of dressing to swim, became a fashion thing.
As seen on Nigella Lawson. Yes, it's taken up a lot, and that crosses over as well to the areas of women who would define themselves as secular, who also dress modestly. And this is one of the things that you see in the discussion fora and on the blogs and on social media, is women from different faiths talking to each other, and also women who are not from a religious background, who, for example, are desperately searching for a dress with sleeves or who want a longer skirt and so on. And sometimes it's women because of their occupations. You know, if you're crawling around on the floor with toddlers at preschool, you don't want to wear low-rise jeans because your bum shows, or just that they want to look professional. But there is also some contestation about who owns the definition of modesty. So is modesty even a usable word? Does it sound too much about self-abnegation? Does it sound too religious? And also, if you are a Orthodox Jewish woman who is buying a hijab pin manufactured by a Muslim brand to hold your Jewish headscarf in place, do you need to de-hijabify it to make it suitably Judaic to wear it? Or do you celebrate it as solidarity with women from other communities who have your interests?
Veronica, you're a big reader of books about fashion, aren't you? And there's a very interesting thing has just happened, which is that on the long list for this year's Samuel Johnson Prize for nonfiction is a biography of Diana Vreeland, who is the doyenne of American Vogue, which I know you went out and bought. Yes. Yeah, she was the Empress of Fashion.
That's the title. But in fact, Fashion with Vreeland comes after Pose, Gesture, Posture, Movement, and a self-projection with which the clothes intersect. But essentially, she was about an acting out, in the very best sense, of a mode of behaviour, an entire attitude towards living and behaving in the world. An absurd attitude, but absurdity taken to great heights can be magnificent. Much of modern fashion, as you've pointed out, Caroline, is about replication. It's about not being unique. It's about showing to the world that you are a standardized unit of modernity. And that's exactly the opposite of what Vreeland wanted and believed in terms of fashion.
It was quite dangerous what she did as well, wasn't it? That she, I mean, she got a bit too close to fascism, didn't she?
Again, it's the strength problem. She wanted to project fashion as not being flimsy or weak. And she was given to the diktat and consequently rather keen on dictators.
That may be true of Vreeland, but I don't think one can argue that the stylization of the self is something that is intrinsically fascist particularly. I mean, admittedly, they did, you know, good stagecraft and good uniforms. But I think that one has to understand this question of self-presentation and embodiment in the sense that Veronica's used it as really a central feature of modernity that isn't really limited to particular ideologies, if you like.
Oh, what a night for sweethearts, stars in the sky above. This is our chance for sweet romance. Let's make this a night of love.
Now, let's move on to clothing in its literary manifestations. Last month, at one of our book clubs, Margaret Atwood told us about an unexplored area of research involving what soldiers wear.
I'm very interested, and I actually have quite a large military library. I'm very interested in clothing technologies and the effects that they have had on armies. A neglected field of study, but for instance, Napoleon took no winter clothing when he invaded Russia. Bad mistake. The pants in the Korean War were made of nylon, but nylon, when you walk, goes psh, 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 psh. It made people very audible. Bad clothing to have for a war that was fought a lot in the dark by guerrillas. People should never, in World War II, have lit their cigarettes by striking the match on their zippers. Very visible. Snipers.
I was so intrigued by this thought that I decided to start a conversation on the book's website about clothing in fiction. And one of the contributors to that blog joins us today. She's Moira Redmond, who has a blog called Clothes in Books, which I didn't actually know about until now. Let's first listen in to some opinions that came in on our own blog.
Hi, Louisa May Alcott made clothing an issue in several of her novels. In Little Women, Meg's borrowed finery as a teenager and her purchase of an expensive violet silk as an adult are major life lessons for her. ACW, ACW.
S. Withering says, when we first see Sarah in John Fowle's The French Lieutenant's Woman, quote, her hair was pulled tight back inside the collar of the black coat, which was bizarre, more like a man's riding coat than any woman's coat that had been in fashion these 40 years, end quote. The coat appears to be a physical signifier to the townspeople, and to Charles, of Sarah's fallen status, but later it proves to be a disguise.
I've always loved the detailed description of Ursula and Gudrun's clothes at the beginning of Women in Love, as they attend a wedding. The clothes, and particularly the colours, seem to be important as indicators of the sisters' different personalities. Katie Bird.
Balzac's Colonel Chabert is described in terms of a shabby old caped coat and a pair of leaky down-at-heel boots. And Proust, with his cartoonist eyes for focusing on pertinent details in Swan's Way, describes the guests at a society gathering in terms of their monocles. Each person's character is expressed in his manner of wearing his eyeglass. Frustrated artist.
Don't Patrick Bateman's outfits become increasingly outlandish as he loses it in American Psycho? Dylan Wolf.
Moira, are you familiar with those examples? I was particularly intrigued by the American Psycho one.
Well, yes, the clothes and the brand names in that book, which when it was first written, I think people thought that it was just him being stupid. But actually, it's a very key part of the image that it's creating of Patrick Bateman. And as the book goes on, you're thinking, hang on, what is this man doing? Is this man real? And I think these are the questions that Bret Easton Ellis wants us to ask, actually. And the brand names and the bizarre outfits he wears and the importance to him of his shirts and his ties and his suits is part of the character, a huge part of the character.
The Los Angeles Times, which I was delighted to see picked up on our blog, quoted the novelist Sheila Hetty as saying, it's not terribly useful to see outfits. I think it's much more useful to see thinking. Veronica, is there any truth in this? This was the thing that actually a few people on the blog said. They poo-pooed the whole idea about talking about clothes.
Clothes are just one form of shorthand for character. You've got to hope that the whole of your potential audience knows exactly what you're talking about. The earliest brand name game I know is in Restoration Fiction, where returning fashionables from Paris mention item by item where they got it from, and the whole audience was expected to know. It's a very quick way of building character if you can be sure that all your readers or listeners share the same set of definitions. If not, then you have to pick clothing which is generic but characterful, or go for a detail described very carefully so that it can be understood even by those who haven't seen it in vogue.
Now, Maura, you've got one of those on your website, which is from Daphne du Maurier's incredibly creepy Don't Look Now, where you describe the first sighting of what they think is a child wearing a short coat over her minute skirt, a pixie hood covering her head.
I think that is one of the creepiest things in all fiction, and also in the film, it must be said, Nicholas Roeg's film. And I think for a lot of people my generation, people who either read the story or saw the film, they cannot see a child in a red raincoat without getting the creeps. In fact, there's something interesting, which actually it isn't red in the book. It's not specific that it's red. It's red in the film.
But what you do on your blog, as well as use the words, is you create images and you create a sort of a really creepy looking puppet with a hood over its head that looks as if it's sort of an executioner's hood in red. So you're picking up this idea of it being red.
Yes, I thought I had to do it as red because that is how we see it. I honestly think there's a generation of women who would not buy a red raincoat for that reason, who saw that film.
And I got to Dickens's David Copperfield and his raging agonies on the night of the race ball, which forced him to wear his newest silk neckerchief continually to immure himself against the prospect of the eldest Miss Larkins dancing with the military.
I love that piece because it's actually very modern. It's very beautifully written. And he's talking about, I'm wearing a long-tailed coat. I'm wearing bear's grease on my head. I've got a gold ring. What does this mean? I'm in love. I'm in love with her. And honestly, that could come from a Nick Hornby book of today with suitable changes. Bear's grease would be hair gel today. There'd be something else instead of the tailcoat. But going to what Veronica said about it being shorthand, that is such brilliant shorthand. And it talks across the generations. You don't need to know what bear's grease is. You can take it from that. This is a young man. He's a bit of a dandy. He's quite vain. He's going to tell us later that he likes sumptuous waistcoats and his shoes are a bit tight. And so you know who he is and you can put him into a 21st century. You can see that man in the 21st century and you can understand he's in love. And that the narrator is describing this in a kind of rueful and self-deprecating way.
He also wears a buttonhole.
He wears a flower and he gives it to the young lady and asks for one back from her. And that's it's a big investment because he's paid 2 and 6
for a pink camellia.
Pink camellia. Japonica camellia, I think. And I used a calculation on the internet to find out that that will be £6 today, which is a lot for a young man. He's only about 17 or 18, I think. In his, he hasn't got very much money, but he's bought this flower and he presents it to his young lady.
Veronica, you have a line which you've quoted to me often about, it's Laurence Olivier's line about building character from the shoes.
And other actors have quoted similar. Thora Heard used to say you did it with a handbag. The idea is that that will give you the key to how they hold their bodies, and the shoes, of course, will give you the key to how they move. The simple matter of heels for men, for example, entirely determines a century's worth of stage behaviour from the late 17th through the 18th century. David Garrick was playing Macbeth in shoes that had lifts, visible lifts. The single garment that you feel from the inside, it's not necessarily a visible from the outside thing. Michael Chabon's wonderful essay in The New Yorker about what a cape does for superheroes and for small boys who want to be superheroes, imitating it with a bath towel. It's a transmutation of your sense of yourself, and that is actually quite easy to work into literature. It works to project a sensation both of you as an individual character and where you are in your society and in the zeitgeist.
Do you have a lot of capes in
your
blog?
I don't think I have had many capes.
Don't have many caped crusaders?
No.
You don't have Dumas, who, I mean, there were capes, weren't there? A lot of capes in the musketeers had capes, didn't they?
They're wearing period costume. They're essentially projecting an extreme romanticism. But there's a carryover. The dressiest writer I can think of was Dumas Père's contemporary, Balzac. Balzac will give you everything but the price tag.
I do fewer men than women just because the illustrations are nicer for women, it has to be said, in the end. And there's a lot of descriptions of men in tweed suits, not on my blog, in literature, and that's not quite so interesting. Dorothy L. Sayers is very interested in how Lord Peter looks. He's always very, very beautifully presented. There's a lot of men talking about women and talking about women's clothes, which is always interesting. I've had the odd one, a recent writer writing a book set in the 30s, and he has his heroine going to the loo, and another person is watching her, and it says she pulled up her hose afterwards. Well, she didn't. It was 1930-something. She was wearing stockings. This is a man, and he thinks she's wearing tights. He's got it wrong. And I just thought, ugh! I just went, no, you've lost me now, because I know you're wrong. But there's other, I mean, historical novels with the maid wearing tights, woolly tights in the winter. Well, she wasn't wearing tights. She was wearing stockings. And it's not hard to get that right. There's a lovely story of Evelyn Waugh when he wrote Brideshead Revisited. Nancy Mitford, who was a great friend, wrote to him after reading a proof copy and said, It's wonderful. I love it. There's one mistake. You have Julia going out to dinner and she's wearing diamond clips. No. It's far too early for diamond clips. She should be having a diamond arrow in her cloche hat. And he changed it. It's a change in the second edition, I think. He takes that out because she's told him. She's put him right on what you actually wore, which I think is a lovely story.
Do you read? How much do you read?
I read a huge amount. I always have. I read very, very fast. And I read, I would probably read 5 books a week.
How many references do you have so far?
I've done almost 600. I'm coming up to my 600th entry. And some of them are very light and flowy. Some of them I actually investigate. I research them quite hard. And so there's a connection. In one of Nancy Mitford's books, there's a reference to somebody dressing as Doris Keane in Romance. And I never knew what that was. And then I came across the same reference in Travels with My Aunt by Graham Greene. And I thought, well, what is this? What is Doris Keane in Romance? And so I found out. And it was an incredibly successful play, which ran for years with this woman playing an opera singer. It's a bit like La Traviata. You know, she's an opera singer, and so she can't marry the dean. And everybody would have known what it was when those books were written, but nobody's ever heard of it now. And I found pictures of Doris Keane in Romance. So I found out what Cedric would have worn for the ball. And then somebody wrote to me and told me much more about it. That's her second act costume, he said. That was the kind of helpful person he was. And then she was married to a British film actor who turned up in another entry that I did. It's just lovely the way it all connects.
Are you going to write a book of this, or is this always going to live as a blog?
I think it would make a very nice book, actually. I love the continuation. I love the way I'm coming up to my 600th entry, and I can still remember what I did, and I think, that connects with that. I love making those connections.
Actually, curiously enough, I think it's almost more fun as a blog, because the blog is a continuing conversation. Once you've tied them up neatly in bunches in a book, then that conversation has ceased. Whereas even your earliest ones, the conversation is ongoing and it leads to constant pickups on things. For example, today we were talking about clothing, which is determined by what men see of women. In every sense. And I went back to a particular entry. Seth Starkadder wandering in on Flora Post, quietly embroidering a petticoat. He hopes and thinks it's knickers, stands there asking her what she's doing and accusing her of bedazing men with the falbalals, etc. And she says composedly, it's an afternoon tea cloth.
That's Cold Comfort Farm, of course, which you know so well, you didn't even mention it. The parody to end all parody of what we've been talking about today.
It is, and it is a book in which there is not one textile, one hairdo, one complete outfit, which is not so precise that just the information coded in that is enough to tell you everything you want to know about the characters.
Life is so uncertain, and no one seems to know how long we have to linger on. Tomorrow we may both be gone. Love me tonight.
So thanks to all our guests for opening up whole new worlds to me. Caroline Evans' The Mechanical Smile is published by Yale University Press. Modest Fashion, Styling Bodies Mediating Faith by Rena Lewis is published by IB Taurus. Thanks also to Veronica Horwell and Moira Redmond, whose blog is called Clothes in Books and is a delight. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Don't wait until the moon is old. Love me tonight. Here we are together, the moon is hanging low, there's magic in its silvery light. It seems to say the time is right, love me tonight. Life is so uncertain, and no one seems to know how long we have to linger on.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.